Hello and welcome. I'm Megan Crabtree, and one of my favorite times of the day is when I'm getting ready and can throw on a true crime case without distraction. Every week, we dive into a new case while you grab your makeup, sip your coffee, and get ready with murder. Imagine being home with your husband and some friends on a Saturday night, enjoying a quiet evening together, playing dominoes, and awaiting your teenage daughter to return home from her school dance with her boyfriend. Everything is peaceful. Until suddenly you hear a car hitting the curb outside of your house and the sound of your daughter's boyfriend screaming, "Mr. Walker, Mr. Walker, help me." In a jolt, you jump up to see what is going on, only to open the door to your daughter's boyfriend with blood gushing down his face. And your daughter, she's nowhere in sight. This is the story of the murder of Carla Walker. For many that live in small town America, you are aware of Friday night lights. The entire community will come together to watch the local high school's football team. In 1974, in Fort Worth, Texas, that was how Carla and her boyfriend, the star quarterback of the football team, Rodney McCoy, would spend their weekends. Carla and Rodney were absolutely adorable together. Every high school memory of anyone listening, I am sure that you probably remember the one it couple of your class. And let me tell you, Carla and Rodney were the it couple. Their classmates described them as, quote, the cool kids, because they were the football player and cheerleader couple. They just seemed to have it all. The Valentine's dance was quickly approaching, and I'm sure that you can imagine Carla was just beyond excited to attend this dance with her boyfriend. The day of the dance, Rodney went to work his shift at a local gas station. He went home to change and then quickly head back out and pick up Carla so that they could head to the dance. Only halfway to her house, he realizes, like, oh crap, I forgot the corsage. And he has to go back to his house and retrieve it. He knows he's in big trouble because he was already running late before he had to go back to his house, but there was no way that he was going to go pick her up without that corsage in hand. When he finally got to her house, Carla was clearly unhappy, but she quickly resolved those feelings and they drove to dinner and then they headed to the dance. When they arrived to the high school, they found it completely decked out in decorations with the theme of, quote, love is a kaleidoscope, which made me giggle because I'm not sure like how much more 1970s you could get than that. But Carla and Rodney and her friends, they had a blast. They danced the night away and they truly seemed to be in love with one another. In fact, Rodney had recently given her a promise ring and they were truly high school sweethearts. So the dance came to an end, but Carla and Rodney were not ready for the night to be over. They decided to go for a ride and meet another couple at Taco Bell, which was like their local teen hangout spot at the time. And they continued driving around with this other couple, you know, just hanging out and having a great time until around 12:30 a.m. when Rodney dropped the other couple back off at their car while he and Carla decided to keep cruising around for a little while. Now, while they are driving around, Carla is like, oh, I need to use the restroom. So Rodney decides to stop at the local bowling alley to let her go inside and go. Afterward, they returned to the car in the parking lot and Rodney described it as, you know, one thing leading to another, and the teens start kissing and then they're making out. And Carla, she leaned her head back like on the passenger door armrest and propped her purse behind her head as like a pillow. And then, as you know, they're enjoying their time together. Within moments, the passenger door suddenly burst open and standing there was a complete stranger with a gun in his hands. As the door opened, both Rodney and Carla's heads kind of like fell out of the car due to the way that they were positioned. And without skipping a beat, this man starts wailing on Rodney, hitting him with the pistol. So then this man points the pistol at Rodney's face and he begins to pull the trigger at least three times, only it just clicks. No bullets come out. And at this point, the man grabs Carla by her arm and pulls her out of the vehicle while simultaneously swinging this pistol at Rodney with his other hand. So Carla begins to yell at this man and says, quote, stop hitting him, stop hitting him, I'll go with you, unquote. Rodney has been beaten in the head with a pistol at this point, and he is just struggling to hold himself upright and get the blood wiped away from his eyes. So he fails to get, you know, a good, decent look at who this person even is. So now we find ourselves back to where I was talking about at the beginning of the story of Rodney pounding on the walker's door with blood just gushing down his face. And Carla's brother, Jim, he remembers looking up at Rodney and visualizing this large cut across his cheek with blood just everywhere. Jim remembers at just 12 years old how panicked Rodney was in those moments, and immediately Carla's parents, Leighton and Doris Walker, called the police. But Leighton, he didn't skip a beat. He runs out of the door with his pistol in hand and heads to the bowling alley where Rodney had explained that this had happened. The next thing Rodney knows, he is taken to the hospital to be treated for his wounds, and he starts to tell the story to the police. Rodney recalls seeing Carla in those last moments, that he had his eyes on her and she screamed to him, quote, "Rodney, go get my dad." And that those were the very last words that he ever heard her say. Rodney, he completely blacked out at that point. He went headfirst into the seat of his car, and he had no idea like how long he had actually been out before he came to. And the very thought that he had was that he had to go and get Mr. Walker. The Walker's home just so happened to be just around the corner from the bowling alley down a hill. So after finding no sign of his daughter, Leighton Walker, he returns back home confused and terrified. Carla's sister remembers that after a while after Carla went missing, she would actually sleep on the couch in the living room, just like listening and waiting for Carla to come home. And Carla's brother, Jim, well, he goes on to explain that the next couple of days following Carla's disappearance were, quote, intense. Recalling that the Fort Worth Police Department and Texas Rangers and the FBI were just all over his home. It was like everything that he ever knew flipped upside down in an instant. Carla was a missing puzzle piece in so many people's lives. She was one of five children. She was so popular with her friends at school. And as you can imagine, Rodney not only missed her, but he felt incredibly responsible for her going missing. And Carla's big sister, Cindy, she described her as like a little spitfire. Carla was barely 100 pounds. She was so tough, so sweet, but she was also very stubborn. She was someone who never gave up easily, and they actually both shared a room together for 17 years. They were basically attached at the hip. So Carla missing was a huge interference in so many people's lives, and so many wanted to figure out where she was. Now, 4 days after Carla went missing, a patrol officer spotted something in a culvert on this like remote road southwest of town, and so he called it in. Jim Mentor was a criminal investigator that was called to report to the scene. And when he got to the culvert, there were already 30 or more police officers there. And as they began to investigate the scene, they discovered that it was a young female body in this culvert. And they had no doubts at all that this was Carla. Officers described her laying there, appearing just to be asleep. She had large gashes in her legs, and she was lying on her back with her clothes torn and some bruising to her neck. Officers believe that she put up an incredible fight against her attacker. The culvert ran underneath the road, and it was approximately 30 feet long and just tall enough for somebody to stand up in. Investigators went inch by inch through this crime scene, identifying any and all pieces of physical evidence that they came across. The area where the culvert was in the country was like a place that very few people intentionally went to unless they lived out there or they were traveling to this nearby lake. But it was February at the time, so the traffic was even less because nobody's going to the lake in February. So the culvert itself was only 9 miles from where Carla was taken, and it was in a location where it was difficult to visualize from the road, which quickly led investigators to believe that someone had thoroughly thought this entire thing out and planned it. Carla's body was taken in for an autopsy while investigators continued to investigate the crime scene. You have to remember too that at the time it was 1974. Technology was up and coming, and investigators knew that while they didn't have what they needed at the time to determine a lot of the evidence, like scientifically, they believed it wouldn't be long at all before this type of technology would exist. So they did like a fantastic job at preserving the scene and taking everything that they could and like putting it away in a way that was to not contaminate it, sealing it perfectly, and submitting it into evidence. Now, they had no way of knowing this then, but these moves to be so careful with every single bit of evidence at this scene, well, it would be critical in the coming years. Of course, the sheriff's department went to notify Layton and Doris Walker and take them to identify Carla's body. Carla's brother, Jim, he remembers waiting in the car in the parking lot, watching his parents enter these like double doors, and within moments, hearing his mom scream from inside of this building. Ronnie recalls being with Carla's sister, Cindy, when a relative came and like told them the news. And Ronnie says that he just collapsed to his knees, and Cindy held onto him, and they both just cried. As autopsy results came in, it confirmed that Carla had been sexually assaulted and strangled to death. The town completely packed her funeral. Jim remembers it being standing room only due to the amount of people that showed up, which is crazy. Now, investigators were there too. They were taking pictures in the background of literally every single person. They believe that the killer was probably there in attendance at her funeral. So Carla's murder changed everything among her friend group. They no longer were these like carefree teens just hanging out. They no longer wanted to go to their local hangout spots and enjoy their teenage years. There was this constant fear and anxiety of Carla's murderer still being out there just waiting. Like I was saying before, the 70s were a completely different time in regard to technology and investigative techniques. There were no cameras everywhere. There was no ability to detect DNA and evidence. And there was so very little that these investigators had to work with at the time that Carla was murdered. Now, what they did have was Rodney. He saw the entire thing happen. And investigators had hoped that he would be able to actually identify the killer. The only problem was that Ronnie had been hit over the head multiple times during this attack, and he had blacked out. He honestly didn't really remember much at all. So they decided to try something a little controversial, and they put Rodney under hypnosis. During the hypnosis, Rodney recalls the event to the best of his ability, and he was actually able to describe the assailant well enough for them to draw a sketch of this guy. While this hypnosis was happening, Rodney is just bawling and essentially starting to have like a panic attack, to where one of the investigators even said like he was worried they were going to have to take him to the hospital due to his mental state that this had all put him into. So while he was under this hypnosis, Rodney had actually described the guy as like a cowboy. This thought then gave investigators a hunch that perhaps this man had traveled into town for the annual rodeo. Investigators went out and interviewed tons of people at this rodeo, like contestants and clowns, etc., but it turned out to be a complete dead end. Now, through the investigation, investigators never stopped looking at Rodney. I mean, he was alone with her and he was the last person to see her alive. So how could they not look at him? Rodney recalls saying, quote, "It doesn't take long to figure out that you are a suspect," unquote. He describes being both a victim and a witness. Investigators continue to grill him with questions over time, and Rodney remembers them just asking the same questions over and over and over again. Police looked at Rodney as the suspect for a few reasons, two of those being that he immediately drove to the Walker's residence rather than the police. And when he was telling them what happened, he described who took her as, quote, "they," implying that there was more than one person at the scene. Now, Rodney describes, for one, he was in complete and total shock, but two, that the police station that was closest to them was 20 or 30 minutes away, whereas the Walker's home was just a couple of minutes down the road, and it just didn't make sense to drive to the police station. So let's circle back to the night of the dance. Remember how they cruised around with another couple for a little while? A freshman named Brenda Wells was in the car with them that night, and investigators went to ask her, like, what was the mood? What was going on as they rode around? And Brenda described it as like, no, it was totally lighthearted. Nobody was fighting. Carla and Rodney were totally normal. They were getting along great. As investigators spoke with more of Carla's friends and family, they only spoke of Rodney's praises, and it was becoming evident quickly that there was just no way that he could have ever hurt Carla. Her family straight up told investigators, we believe him. Like, this is a dead end because this man did not hurt our daughter. Obviously, investigators couldn't completely rule out Rodney, but they did start to widen their investigation once they realized that Rodney was likely not the suspect that they were looking for. Now, when they searched the bowling alley parking lot, they do end up finding Carla's purse and a magazine clip from a gun, which was really interesting because apparently the way that this particular gun was constructed, if the assailant had used it to hit Rodney over the head, it could have been very easy for that magazine to fall out, which explains why when he went to shoot the gun at Rodney, nothing happened. And of course, this also backs up Rodney's story. So they took the magazine and went to determine anyone and everyone who had bought a Ruger pistol in this area around that time. They were able to find 40 people who had, and they went to investigate all of them. Every single person had either an alibi, or they had the gun, or they said their gun was stolen. They did ask 20 of them to submit to a polygraph, but every single one of them declined to. Now, the Walker family did their best to carry on during this time. In fact, Carla's sister, Cindy, she was married 3 months after Carla's murder. Carla was supposed to be her maid of honor. And Carla's mom and dad, well, they had to keep a brave face. They came from this time period of, like, you know, we have other kids and we have to take care of this family. And they basically just would not talk about Carla's murder. And they did their very best to keep their remaining kids having like as best of a childhood as possible. Investigators had hundreds of leads in Carla's case initially, and they worked through every single one until all of the leads started to slow down. That was until a man named Vincent Strange, he is with a podcast called Gone Cold, and he started researching Carla's case and discovered that around 2 months after Carla was murdered, investigators actually arrested the serial killer, Tommy Ray Neyland. He was the killer that got caught because he had abducted a girl in Arlington, and she managed to get away when his truck got stuck in the mud, and then he was later arrested. Now, Tommy Ray Neyland, he admitted to murdering 3 people. And naturally, the cops connected him to Carla's case. They put Tommy in a lineup with a bunch of other men for Rodney to try and identify and had them say, quote, come with me, which were the words that the assailant used when he was taking Carla out of the car. Crazy enough, Rodney picked Tommy. He picked him out of this lineup. However, Tommy, he did not confess to the murder of Carla, though he did confess to these other murders. So investigators were stumped because it's like, if you're gonna confess to these 3 murders, like, why wouldn't you just add another one on if you did it? Like, it kind of made them think that. So 3 years later, another suspect emerged, and his name was Jimmy Dean Sasser. Now, one day, this man walks into a police station near Nashville, Tennessee, and he tells them that he is responsible for the murder of Carla Walker, and they immediately call the Fort Worth, Texas police. Now, the main investigator in Carla's case was not buying Jimmy's story. According to Vincent Strange, this man apparently got drunk pretty often and would just go and confess to crimes that he didn't actually commit, you know, as one does. And he was held and released after 8 months when Jimmy recanted this confession. Years continued to go by without an answer for Carla's murder. After high school, Rodney decided not to go to college, and he actually moved to Alaska to work on the oil rigs out there. He says in an episode of Dateline that he left Fort Worth because he just could not live with the guilt. Rodney says, quote, Carla saved my life. I wish it would have been the other way around,
unquote.
For so many years, all that Rodney could think about was how terrified Carla must have been in those final moments and how he wasn't able to save her. So Carla's sister, Cindy, she went on to have a daughter and she named this daughter Carla and describes her as even having some of the characteristics that Carla did, which is pretty cool because it seems like Carla was living on through her. And then Carla's brother, Jim, he found himself attending the same high school as Carla in the late 70s and was just such an angry and like frustrated teenager over what had happened to his sister. He even recalls spending the night in the culvert where she was found. He had hoped in some really weird way that the killer would return to the scene of the crime and he could finally kill him and get justice for Carla. Jim actually went on to have a career in law enforcement and he ended up working at the Fort Worth Police Department. But he ended up having a genetic eye condition and he was starting to go blind, so he had to retire. Now, Leighton Walker, their father, he died in 1987, and so Jim moved into their family home to care for his elderly mother, and then he actually ended up buying the house that they lived in after his mom passed. And I'm sure you're like, why did he do that? Because he didn't want to miss the opportunity of somebody possibly knocking on that door at like 3 a.m. with this guilty conscience and finally, you know, admitting to Carla's murder. More than 30 years passed by and Carla's case remained cold. Carla's brother Jim recalled thinking that solving Carla's case was going to be a marathon and not a sprint. He knew that it was going to take time to get there. Detective Sarah Waters took on Carla's case in 2005 and she sent Carla's dress to the crime lab to see if they could spot any new DNA evidence. And the lab called her back and told her that the dress actually had a small stain that was the perfect shape of a sperm. Now, by 2005, DNA testing was a brand new way of solving cases. Naturally, Rodney's DNA was on the dress because they had been in physical contact that night. And the lab did find another profile of an unknown male. However, this profile was incomplete. So Waters had it compared to other DNA connected over the years in the case. And basically they were doing this so that they could rule out any kind of suspect that they had already had in the files. They even compared it to that serial killer, Tommy Ray Neeland, and he was immediately eliminated. And then by 2015, Waters had compared this DNA to literally every single suspect in Carla's case and eliminated all of them. But now it was time for Waters to retire. And she knew at that point it would take new technology to solve this case. Little did they know, 3 years later, that technology was going to come in 2018. The newest detective on the case, her name was Leah Wagner, and she had Jim call her one day. And Jim was like, I want the Texas Rangers to look into my sister's case because he knew they are running out of time. Whoever did this was either dead or dying by this point. So Wagner, she dove back into Carla's case and she came up with 83 names to look back into and see if there was any possible DNA connection to them. They interviewed as many people as they could during this time and they asked every male if he would voluntarily give their DNA. But every man that they came up with was eliminated. At this point, they decide to post about this case on Facebook because they're just desperate. Like, what else is there left to do? And a woman, she posted this post and was like, I think I know who killed Carla. Well, you know, that's crazy. And this tip leads investigators to a brand new person of interest. The woman that posted this told them that she believed her ex-husband killed Carla. Apparently, when they went through this divorce, the woman found this like old metal box in her husband's belongings. And inside were a bunch of newspaper clippings about the murder. And he only lived like a couple of blocks from Carla at the time that she was murdered. This man's name was Stephen Clare, and he was 17 at the time of the murder. In fact, Carla and Stephen, they were acquainted. So investigators called this guy in for an interview and they ask him about the box. And he's like, yeah, I had a box, but it's all filled with just, you know, typical memorabilia from my life. And it wasn't just stuff pertaining to Carla Walker. That was just a massive thing that happened in my life. And so I kept a newspaper clipping. He was just, you know, sentimental apparently. And he would randomly save things like this. So he also told detectives, you know, I also had an alibi that night. He was actually in Austin, Texas, the night that Carla was murdered. And he did submit a DNA sample and he was quickly ruled out. So another dead end. But here's the thing. Investigators could not let go of Rodney being the perpetrator. They just could not rule him out. As they dug through Carla's file, they found three letters sent to the police, and all three of these letters accuse Rodney of being the murderer. However, there was no proof in any of these letters. They were just total accusations. So investigators tore Rodney's story apart, and they decide to go and do the drive from the bowling alley to the Walker's residence like Rodney would have done that night. Now, Rodney had told investigators back in 1974 that he had likely woken up around like 5 minutes or so after he'd been knocked unconscious. Now, investigators used this against him, and they explained that there was this time gap of at least 30 to 45 minutes that Rodney just couldn't account for. But I mean, if you're asking me, the man was guessing when he woke up. It's not like he was looking at a clock. He had just blacked out. It wasn't etched in stone. There's just a lot of leeway, in my opinion, for time here because he was literally unconscious. So now they decide to make a trip from the bowling alley to the culvert where she was found and then back to the Walker's house. And they determined that this trip could have been made in less than 45 minutes, kind of, you know, going with this story that they're creating. So they wonder again, you know, why didn't he just go to the police station or why didn't he use the phone at the bowling alley? But they also find out during this time that Carla's siblings had told detectives that even though they always believed Rodney, they were bothered by the fact that the blood on Rodney's face had actually dried and it wasn't actively bleeding when he had come to the front door. It led them, you know, just to having questions. At the time, they didn't think about it, but looking back, it's kind of weird. They also really didn't feel good about Rodney referring to this assailant as they rather than he or one person. They also had a really hard time believing that this person had pulled a gun and attempted to fire three times because according to investigators, this type of gun, it was like physically impossible for the click to happen after the magazine was out of the gun. And Rodney describes this experience as hearing three clicks. But again, trauma can do some crazy things. You can remember things that didn't necessarily happen. So there's that. So after Rodney had moved away from Texas and went to Alaska to work on those oil rigs, he had met a woman and married her, and they later had three children, and he earned an engineering degree. And then he ended up moving back to Texas and divorced his wife and became a grandfather. He had even gotten back in touch with Carla's family and friends when he had moved back. Now, when he had gotten back to Texas, the investigators wanted to interview him again. When he walked into the interview, the investigators described him as looking just defeated, and that you could tell the toll that Carla's murder had taken on him throughout the years. Investigators were still highly suspicious though, but without them having anything linking him to the crime, they had to let him go. Now, suddenly, this guy named Paul Holes from the show The DNA of Murder with Paul Holes, well, he wanted to dive into Carla's case. So this is the same man that helped lead to the arrest of the Golden State Killer. So as you can imagine, investigators are like thrilled to bring him on. And Paul is an expert in genealogical DNA, which can identify suspects through their relatives. It's a very expensive process, but producers of this guy's TV show, they provided $18,000 to help cover the cost. Investigators sent Carla's dress and the rest of her clothing to this lab in California. Rewind back to the original detectives in 1974. And thank God for them because they had packaged the evidence so carefully, knowing that technology could improve in the future, that everything was intact and ready to be further examined. On the strap of Carla's bra was a perfectly preserved single sperm cell. From that sample, the lab was able to develop a full male profile and checked it into the DNA national database, but they didn't have any kind of hit. So then they got the sample to a genealogy lab in hopes of finding one of the assailant's relatives. Now, when you test DNA samples, they are used up. They're gone. Like you can only use them one time during a test. So you only have so many options. The one perfect DNA sample that they had, it was used up in the lab when they were able to obtain that DNA profile. And so now they're at this dead end again. Investigators had one last card to play. Lab techs found just one last very tiny sample of DNA on the bra strap. but it was degraded because Carla's DNA was also mixed into it. So a sample like this would typically be untestable, but they found a lab where these techs were able to like do this all of the time. They would take degraded DNA and they were able to build complete profiles from it. But this was it. This was their very last chance to come up with a DNA profile and match. So in May of 2020, investigators decided to go for it and they sent the sample into this lab. 5 weeks later, the lab created a full profile and used genealogical mapping to find a family name, which was McCurley. The investigators immediately paused because they recognized this name in their case file, Glenn Samuel McCurley. The lab stops them and says, well, that guy died in 1972, so there's no way that he could have done this because Carla died in 1974, until they realized that he had a son named Glenn Samuel McCurley Jr. They determined he was, in fact, living in Fort Worth, Texas at the time, and the reason that he was originally on the suspect list, well, it was because he owned a Ruger gun. McCurley had told police that his Ruger had actually been stolen, and he was cleared. Because why, friends? Well, he passed a polygraph test. Yeah, this is why we don't trust those. So they found out where he was living, and it was actually just a few miles from the bowling alley with his wife, and they sent this officer to his home. The officer wore a body cam and pretended to just be conducting like a welfare check, and McCurley, he comes around the other side of the home. You can see this in the footage, and he immediately throws his hands into the air in like a surrender pose, and it was clear in his mind that after all these years, he had finally been caught. But the officer was so smooth, and he like talks to him about a parking violation. And McCurley, he starts to settle down a little bit and like make small talk with this officer, explaining that he had been living in Fort Worth since the 70s and worked often as a long haul truck driver with plans of retirement soon. So the officer leaves the home, sends the officers back later to go to his home and like go through McCurley's trash in the middle of the night and then take some stuff to get his DNA. And what ended up happening was a McDonald's straw ended up giving the perfect DNA match. Now, here's the thing. They knew they had to get this right the first time and make sure the case was a sure win. So when they returned to the McCurley home again with a voice recorder, they brought up Carla Walker and they asked him for a sample of his DNA. And he's like, well, they already took my DNA back in the 70s. But his wife is sitting there and she's like, what? Boy, no, they did not, because they did not have DNA back then. You silly goose. And so he's like looking at her like, are you kidding me right now? Are you kidding me right now? And they ask him at that point, so what were you doing the week that Carla died? And he was like, well, I was probably driving my wife around because she didn't drive. And then the wife pops back in again. And she's like, no, I wasn't with you that week. Don't you remember? And she's basically building this case against him. And in the end, he finally just submits and is like, okay, you can have a sample of my DNA and I'll save you the drama. But like, obviously it matched. It was a perfect match. On September 21st, 2020, they bring in Glenn McCurley for the murder of Carla Walker to start questioning him. And after an hour, they finally got a confession. He tells them that he was 31 at the time and drunk, and he was looking for a victim. And he recalls pistol whipping Rodney and taking Carla, but he refused to admit that he raped her. He just said that they had sex. Yeah, because that, I hate people like that. I mean, obviously I hate him because he's a murderer, but still, you know what I mean? He also admitted that he still had the Ruger pistol. It was never stolen. It was actually hidden in like the attic of his home. So Jim remembers hearing the news and just being elated. Jim is so pumped. Like as soon as he hears this, he's like, finally, finally, after all of these years, they got him. He texts his sister Cindy, and Cindy was like actually driving around with a friend. And so she hands her phone to the friend, is like, hey, read me this text message. And the text, all it says is, we've got him. And it's like this moment of celebration. Like, finally, you know, their sister's killer, you guys, had been living down the street this entire time, just right down the road. And Jim called Rodney and told him, we got him, Rodney, like we've got him. And Rodney, I mean, this poor guy, he had doubts that this day was ever going to come and that nobody would ever really know. And that the suspicion of him doing this to Carla would just linger with him until he himself died. And now it was this relief. Everyone knew the truth, and there was just no more questioning. Nothing was left in the air anymore. So initially, Glenn McCurley pleaded not guilty despite his confession, and they took the case to trial, and Rodney was the first witness in this trial. And Rodney explains that he had a lot of anxiety that day, as like, I'm sure anybody would. And he had waited, 47 years for this moment. The prosecutors described his testimony as this very impactful moment in the courtroom. And then on day three of the trial, before his attorneys could even bring his defense, McCurley gave up and he changed his plea to guilty. And he was later sentenced to life in prison. The entire room, when this sentencing happened, was just filled with emotion. And in fact, like, Jim ended up comforting Glenn McCurley's own son. He describes him as being just completely heartbroken. He just learned that this father he's known his whole life was this complete monster and committed this crime. And so Jim embraced the son of the man that killed his sister that day. Now, here's a crazy part, you guys. During the police interview with McCurley, they ask him, why did you select the spot that you did to place her? And McCurley describes it as, well, it was against this building. But the culvert where she was found wasn't against a building, you guys. Remember, it's like in the middle of nowhere, which leaves detectives wondering if this was the only murder he ever committed, because was he maybe just confusing details from a different case? So they ask him if there was another girl he could have done this to. And McCurley was like, quote, pretty sure that he had only done this to Carla and no one else. And like, why would you say, like, I'm pretty sure I've only done this once? I'm pretty sure you would remember if you did it more than once. So, you know, investigators have a strong feeling that Carla was not his first victim or his only victim. There was actually a woman named Becky Martin who was 21 years old, just I think it's like a year prior to when Carla went missing. And she was abducted in the parking lot of her junior college. And her case was very similar to Carla's. They say he is a person of interest in her case, as well as at least two other women, both of those women being snatched from their cars, very similar to how Carla was. So did McCurley leave some other victim by a building? We may never know, because McCurley later died in prison. Well, guys, that's the case for today. I hope you enjoyed getting ready with me today, and I hope that you have the best day ever. Stay aware and stay safe out there. Bye.